These are the true stories of farmers, conservationists, sustainable ag advocates, and researchers dedicated to advancing public policies to achieve a sustainable farming and food system in the United States. Find out what happens when people take action and start caring for the land.
It's August 17th, 2015. We're in Ron and Kimberly's backyard, and today we're talking with Denny Kenneff from the Rivers Alliance of Wisconsin, but who's also in the past was involved in some of the early meetings in the Midwest, particularly of a group that then became a part of the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition. So, Denny, tell me a little bit about, to starting out with your own background, even as a kid growing up, what led you to have an interest in agriculture and sustainable agriculture, even more broadly in the environment. Give us some background.
Sure. Funny you should mention, as a kid, because I grew up in rural Minnesota, south of Hastings. My parents didn't farm, but a lot of relatives did. All the neighbors did. I worked on farms. So leap to the mid-80s in graduate school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I was working for the Ag Press Service of the College of Ag, which is the Ag Press Service was the propaganda organ of the College of Agriculture. And we were in the middle of the farm crisis. And they were doing a series of stories about the farm crisis. And it was amazing how much the academics blamed farmers for making bad decisions. And I thought, this didn't seem right to me.
And that was about mid-80s, early 80s?
It was 85, yeah. 86.
Yep.
And Wisconsin was a little bit insulated from that because of the dairy. There's so much, the dairy industry was still at the time quite strong. And so they weren't so dependent on a grain farming, which had kind of collapsed across the rest of the Midwest because interest rates were high and then the market fell through and then people were stuck with these huge expensive loans. Anyway, there was this undercurrent with these, talking to these academics that farmers made bad decisions. I thought, this just can't be. And then I happened to hear an interview on a public radio call-in show with a farmer named John Carr, who was this brilliant, well-spoken critic of what was going on in agriculture, especially about the university system. He felt was disadvantaging small family farms to the benefit of what he called corporate agriculture, the industrialization of agriculture. And it was, I just stopped the car and listened to him because it was so compelling. And I called him up. I said, I want to come talk to you. And it totally changed the direction of my my academic work. And my master's thesis, which ended up being called Technology Resistance on the Farm. In fact, the term sustainable agriculture was just starting to be used. So this is 86. And they refused to let me use it in the thesis. They said, that's not a term that's considered, you know, academically sound or something like that. So I had to throw out, they had to scrub the whole thing of the term sustainable. I think they let me refer to it once. Otherwise, it would have not have been serious research, I was told. So by then I'm, you know, getting really intrigued by all this. And it turned out at the same time, this farmer that I talked to, John Carr, was a board member of the Wisconsin Rural Development Center, which was Wisconsin's version of the many groups that popped up around the in the Midwest in that time, right, to sort of respond to the farm crisis. And they had a project, and would I be interested in carrying out this project? And it was a classic family farm versus the industrial mentality about farming of a radiologist who had bought up 30 small dairy farms and then turned them into corn and bean deserts. Took out the grass waterways, took out the woodlots, rented out the houses to, you know, not great renters, let the, you know, the outbuildings go to hell. So it was a study, you know, in microcosm of the collapse that was coming. And it was another sort of, an awakening for me, and it really got me engaged in you know, what was going on. And to me, it was the socioeconomic aspect of it was the most interesting, the political aspect. Agronomic piece was also of interest to people of low input farming and organic farming and so forth. And that was all a nice alternative of what was going on. But I really enjoyed understanding the power relationships of how agriculture worked and who was disadvantaged and how they were and what public institutions had to do with that. Of course, you know, farm policy and so forth. So then I came to work in St. Paul for the infamous Bill Norris creation, Midwest and Technology Development Institute, where you rescued me, Ron, and it helped, you know, introduce me to the people in Minnesota. And I think the first Sustainable Ag Working Group, which was a meeting, which was actually before we had a name, I think, in the early 1988. And I was still working for that institute. But so that's brings me up to that spot in time. But like I said, the political and socioeconomic underpinnings of what was going on in rural America and rural Wisconsin, rural Minnesota, was so interesting. And like I say, the public institutions and their role in either fostering that or counteracting it was I think what we were all about, those groups coming together that felt like we had a higher expectation of public institutions than to either sit by idly or in fact actively help bring down family farming.
Right, and it was also private institutions as you were talking. I'm thinking when I was with the Land Stewardship Project at that time, a lot of our battle focused around the insurance companies taking over farms.
Yeah.
And the same sort of thing you talked about, the mistreatment of the land, really the people that had been on it before, that was also part of the farm process at the time. And the other thing I think that was going on there, thanks to writers like Wendell Berry and Wes Jackson and some others, and a thing called the National Agland Studies of the late 70s, early 80s, was a growing awareness of the damage that was being done to the land by this industrial farming that had taken over so much post-World War II. Maybe it wasn't felt quite as much as Wisconsin because of the need for the pastures on the dairies and things, but it was happening there too.
Yeah.
And if you want to talk a little bit about the your view on how things were happening with the Conservation Reserve program that had been passed with the 85 Farm Bill.
Yeah, and by 1988, when we started to meet, I think the benefits of that were all already showing up, and we got excited about what other possibilities were. What things would be possible under CRP, so expand the acreage, have conservation easements that were more permanent than 10-year contracts,
right,
all that kind of stuff. And then when I look back at that and how CRP has essentially almost gone away, we were ahead of our time, and I think CRP helped us see the possibility and the huge importance of farm policy, right, on saving soil, on giving people another alternative to living on corn and beans.
Well, I have with me, getting us back to the, say, 1988, the paper that that Margaret Crome sent out that you actually took the notes for, that then went on to become the kind of founding meeting, I believe, for what was the Sustainable Agriculture Working Group in the Midwest. So, you know, have any comments about that?
Well, Well, I look at that now, Ron, and I go, the audacity of us,
yeah.
And the ambition too.
Yeah.
And I look back and salute us for both of those things. We were telling like we would reform farm policy as if, you know, just getting organized and grabbing a few folks and putting out some position papers and we were going to change policy. So it was amazing. And I think the other thing that when I think about, again, compared to today, when going through those minutes, that we had faith in the federal government responding to us,
yeah,
and responding to these you know, cries for change and a new way to support agriculture and a new approaches to supporting farmers and farming.
Right.
I don't know what it's like to drop into a Sustainable Ag meeting these days and think about trying to get Congress's attention for such thing. But that never occurred to us. I read through those minutes now, and I don't think anybody thought that this was a huge hurdle to jump. That, of course, you know, we'd mobilize people from really the Midwest, and we started talking about getting bigger and pulling folks from the Southeast and the Western Plain states. And it was pretty gutsy for a bunch of advocates in these states to say, well, we're gonna reform the Farm Bill.
Well, and I think I remember back for me with Land Stewardship Project, we were really drawing on the fact that post-Dust Bowl days in the Great Depression of the 30s into the Roosevelt years, the government really did respond in a big way. And we were sort of, at least in part, trying to bring that back to life, that whole notion of the role the federal government could play, with conservation being the lead term to take us there.
You know, the only hint I saw of hesitation or caution, I'm going to say caution, hesitation, of like, what are we up against? Who are we going to run into? There's a reference in there to the grain groups, you know, and I think the unspoken Cargill or you know, the whole grain, big grain apparatus that was dependent on cheap corn. And then trade too came in there, and both of those things, at least in those early meetings, like, we didn't know how to deal with that, but we knew that was a shadow hanging over all of this with these big, you know, other economic forces that whose shins we had to kick to get our way into members of Congress and get their attention for a better way to think about and support agriculture.
Well, and I'd like to talk a little bit about sort of some of the kind of internal struggles that went on too. You know, that was part of it. When we were meeting at the bigger group a couple of weeks ago, when we were looking down at the NSAC's annual meeting, I remarked about how I remembered reading through these things, how democratic the process was, and it also reminded me of how difficult it sometimes was and how agonizingly long the discussions were going on. And I remember seeing in your notes here a quote, "Discussion then led to what form of working group should the working group should take. The idea of a quote unquote working group was preferred to a coalition. Coalition to some implied agreeing on everything. And it was felt that it was not necessary or desirable for this group. Groups could opt to sign on whenever the initiatives as a whole, or to initiatives as a whole, the work that fit in with their respective interests as a group. So we really all the time were trying to think about how to keep the tent together.
Yeah.
And I can even remember some tensions even between Land Stewardship and some of the groups in Wisconsin. I don't know if you have any remember about anything to add about that.
There were a couple of camps that people started to organize around. There was the National Save the Family Farm Coalition, and so there was a group called Farm Unity, Wisconsin Farm Unity Alliance. Mm-hmm. And I think Iowa had one called Prairie Fire. Mm-hmm. Probably every state had a Save the Family Farm group, and the sustainable ag groups were different. We had a different view. I think the Save the Family Farm guys had kind of a commodity pricing and price supports parity orientation, kind of like NFO, where we kind of took a different approach. And I think people weren't going to try and fight over who was right and who was wrong, but it was how to merge. These are pretty different philosophical approaches. And at one of those meetings, Tom Saunders from Wisconsin Farm Unity said, "We have to have a big philosophical discussion." And I thought, I think we probably did. And my recollection of a few of those meetings was that there were two-day meetings, long, you know, into the night, and then there was sort of a morning session and people were gonna have lunch and then hit the road. And I think more work got done in the last hour of the second day than the previous several hours, because like, okay, we gotta come out of here with something that we are gonna do next.
Right.
So despite all that conversation, I think we kept those big philosophical differences at bay. And I think at some point, there was a merger of, I won't say, you know, literal merger, but at least a merging of the philosophies, and realizing we're all kind of up against the same obstacles and we want the same thing from federal farm policy of supporting family farming.
Yes, I think you're exactly right. That's how I would put it too. I mean, there was always sort of respect of each other's views. It wasn't like one is necessarily totally right and you know, they're totally wrong.
Yeah.
It was just different ways of thinking about how to go forward. And of course, we really didn't know for sure how to go forward. So that was just all part of it. But I remember that was a big deal back in the day. And some of it seems a little bit like tempest in a teapot now. But at the time, it was real important when you're trying to build a group, a working group, if not a full-on coalition.
Yeah, those differences were meaningful to people, and they were serious about them. And but I think the leaders of both of those camps saw above it and got above that fray, and I think came to conclude that the forces against both of us were big enough that it made more sense to find ways to come together than to squabble.
There was also another tension I'd like to just acknowledge somewhat that also has, I think, been dealt with largely quite well, and that was sort of the camp of really we have to just strengthen organic agriculture versus sort of a more broadly the attitude that prevailed more within the forces that within the sort of the working group around the whole fairness for family farms and things like that. So that was also another tension.
In Wisconsin, that played out in an interesting way because, you know, Wisconsin's the home of Organic Valley, which is the biggest and most successful organic cooperative that's organized as a cooperative in the country, I think. And, you know, a lot of the elements in the Family Farm Coalition, Farm Unity Alliance, I think they always had a market orientation. They always had a pricing orientation. And in one way, if you were going to get, you know, price supports, then sell your own stuff at some kind of a premium. So the organic movement had a sort of a place to go that way, the kind of a market orientation and skip worrying about, you know, federal farm policy. So, and that's been hugely successful. They've done so well.
So, as I recall, that you stayed with this work for about 6 or 7 years, and then you moved on.
So I started with this Midwest Technology Development Institute in '86, and then I got on the door with this Midwest Technology Development Institute, and then I got hired by the Rural Development Center to go back to Wisconsin and work as its executive director. And of course, that organization was involved in the Sustainable Ag Working Group. So I slid right back in. And then I, you know, we got through the 90 Farm Bill mm-hmm. and the 1995 Farm Bill. And then I left there in April or May of 95. Mm. And then 3 years with American Farmland Trust in the early 2000s. And the work I did, you know, was the regional office, which was 4 states, but there was Farm Bill work, but I didn't have much to do with Farm Bill work. Obviously, AFT was always involved in Farm Bill work, but not right. me personally.
But American Farmland Trust did important work at that time, or was an important group in that with its focus on preserving farmland, keeping farmland in farmland.
Well, it was really interesting, though. You know, I thought it was. I mean, I was personally glad to kind of get back in because that's what I knew. I knew this farm stuff, right. So it was great to kind of get back in that milieu. And then I realized that American Farmland Trust was sort of controversial to more, I don't say radically minded, but kind of radically minded farm advocates because AFT was sort of blind to farming practices, you know? They would say, let's save the land and we're not going to look real hard if it's an industrial dairy right. or, you know, corn and beans or something like that. That's kind of all there was in suburban Illinois where there was a lot of work to save farmland. So it was an interesting, you know, new controversy for me to kind of deal with that by and large, I thought it was a good thing to be saving farmland, but people were pretty critical of asking the question, but saving it for what? If the practices are abusive of land, you know,
yeah, and over the years that I've watched, AFT has gotten more and more involved in policy matters and things like that that were probably more closely aligned with the sustainable agriculture movement.
Yeah, good.
Over the years that I've observed. Well, now how long have you been with the Rivers Alliance?
12 years next month.
12 years, So I'd like to talk a little bit about what you've observed in agriculture's effect on the rivers of Wisconsin. Talk a little bit about the Rivers Alliance and River Alliance of Wisconsin, and then a little bit about ag and its effect and any positives you're seeing. Just kind of noodle around on that a little
Sure.
bit.
There are 85,000 miles of rivers in Wisconsin. It's a watery place. The biggest water quality challenge to rivers in Wisconsin is agriculture, without even a close second to anything else. So if you're going to worry about the quality of the water in rivers, you have to pay attention to what's going on with agriculture. We were talking about the Conservation Reserve Program earlier, and there was a county, Iowa County in Wisconsin, I think, had, as a percentage of the total land base in the county, one of the highest percentages of CRP land in the country. And it was a beautiful place to drive through because there was all this prairie growing. And when the amount of money paid to farmers or landowners for CRP contracts fell off. And then when corn prices took off, thousands of acres of CRP land went under the plow again. And the rivers immediately showed it. This is Iowa and the neighboring Grant County, siltation, nitrates, grass waterways that used to be there were plowed under. It was, this is a huge failure of federal farm policy not to figure out a way to keep, to save that land from heavy erosion. Federal farm policy probably never has had the sway or influence in Wisconsin because of the dairy industry. So people were growing all these forages, which never qualified for, there was never a program for forages. But with the dairy industry changing a lot, so small, medium-sized dairy farms almost completely gone now. We're under 10,000 dairy farms all told in Wisconsin. From when I started the Rural Development Center in 88, it was almost 40,000.
Wow.
So a huge collapse almost. And of course, the numbers of cows has hardly changed. So just, you know, same number of cows, but concentrated in fewer and fewer places. And the big challenge for rivers in Wisconsin around agriculture is manure distribution. Because basically, they're dumping manure. They don't have the land base in a lot of places to make sure the manure is completely taken up by the crop. And so, you know, you get an ill-timed rain, or people spread manure on frozen, snow-covered ground. And then these days in climate change, you get a rain in February on frozen ground and right to the rivers. So we now have huge algae blooms. There's a dead zone in Green Bay, kind of like the one in the Gulf of Mexico, obviously smaller. But these are all, legacies of farming's impact on rivers.
So does the River Association do policy work that's relevant, if not federally, state?
State a lot, yeah. More so than federal policy. The thing most farmers in Wisconsin, livestock especially, dairy, have to pay attention to is the state's regulations of manure distribution. And then the construction of their barnyards. And obviously there are federal programs that farmers would qualify for, but I've, in Wisconsin there's a dance between kind of voluntary incentives, which are really what defines the Natural Resources Conservation Service programs that they deliver to farmers, and the stuff that the state and the counties do, which make people do stuff. But that's a dance. I think there's a cry more and more for really kind of putting the screws to the livestock dairy operations in Wisconsin to require things. I mean, these things have been voluntary for decades, and people are realizing voluntary just doesn't work. And so I think we were working on water quality and, you know, river or lake conservation, aim our efforts at the state because we can more easily influence that. And they, the livestock operations have to pay more attention to the state regulations because those are generally stronger are some are compulsory.
Well, I was wondering, maybe to conclude, if you have anything more, any anecdotes or anything you remember in particular that would be good to kind of have on the record?
Well, I think, this is fun, Ron, to think about. Another ideological struggle that popped up inside the Midwest Sustainable Ag Working Group was how to think and talk about animal welfare. And the animal welfare and the animal rights groups who were saying to us, well, you know, it's great, you're talking about sustainable agriculture, but what about the animals? And that was sort of touchy for us because we're working with these family farmers and we feel like, well, they're good stewards of their animals. But of course, there's the sort of the industrial side of animal raising that was, you know, getting more and more controversial. And I think we were, you know, rightly or wrongly accused of enabling that. So what are we saying about that? So we said, well, there's a balance there. They're not incompatible. These things don't cancel each other out. So we did that publication. It was called, A Case for Sustainable Ag in Animal Welfare. I can't remember. It was a little book. But what I remember, even though I don't remember the title, I remember the struggle that we had internally about what we wanted to say. Feeling like we don't have to placate animal welfare groups. We can make our case and say, this is good animal welfare. And it was a popular publication. I remember it was one of those things that helped kind of put the Sustainable Ag Working Group on the map because we took a controversial subject and played it well and used good, strong arguments. I have not seen Ferd Hefner very often in the intervening years, but I saw him four or five years ago, and he said, two or three times a year, he still gets a call from somebody looking for that publication.
Good.
That it was a statement, I won't say a statement for the ages that overstates it, but it was a pretty strong statement at the time that I think still holds, that, you know, family scale agriculture can do well by animals and can do well by the land. In a ways that the industrial system cannot. And sustainable ag, a cornerstone of it, was what family scale farms, how they raised animals and how they treated their animals. They were not incompatible. They were part and parcel of the same thing.
The kind of industrial side of big animal agriculture wants to label anybody that has any question about it. They immediately say, well, you're just PETA, that group, that they then label as the ultimate animal radicals.
Well, I think, yeah.
It scares everybody to even take the topic up because they immediately throw that out.
I think that was our fear, that there would be this taint with PETA. And the Humane Society of the United States was really good. I mean, they didn't say we shouldn't raise farm animals,
right.
Just avoid eating meat. And I think the argument that we made in the Sustainable Ag Working Group was, you know, animals and manure were, well, in the cycle of crops run through animals, on the back end comes the manure and back to the land put the nutrients back in whence the crops had come and fed the animals. I mean, it was a closed good system that, of course, had been around for as long as people have raised livestock. And doing that right and doing it well, we were convinced was possible. And we knew of examples. But I think the touchiness for the sustainable ag groups was that we even took the thing up in the first place, that we had succumbed to pressure from animal rights groups to sort of prove that animals had a role. And I think for the farmers that we work with, you know, there was always nervousness about even taking that topic up. And it was pretty brave of us to do it, I think. And that publication, I you know, stood the test of time. I had pulled it out a few years ago, and you know, it's still right.
Right. So I don't know if there's anything else we need to really talk about. I just wanted to make sure we got, you know, kind of got you in the archive.
Just the last thought that from the news this morning. So there's talk of Monsanto and Syngenta merging.
Right.
Big giants. Monsanto, obviously, a longtime giant in agriculture, and Syngenta kind of as well. And I think the idea of the two of them coming under one roof is sort of frightening to a lot of people. So in some ways it says, you know, the battles are never over, the challenges remain, and it's incumbent upon people who care about these things to stay at it, and that we've had good influence, we've had positive change. There are all these things we can look to. I really think there's a second food system in the country as a result of a lot of the work that all of our groups did starting in the 80s, that, you know, you can, buy your chicken, buy your vegetables, buy your cheese from somebody you know, somebody down the road. There's this, an amazing system now operating under the radar of the big system, but there it is. If you want to participate in it, you can. And I think that's all a result of us thinking, challenging the world about how agriculture could be different.
This has been part of the National Sustainable Agriculture Oral History Archive, produced by Ron Cruz. Available on the Minnesota Institute for Sustainable Agriculture website. The podcast was made possible by the Center for Rural Affairs.